Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
First, what the decision to charge Officer Yanez means for other police departments and other communities. As Ramsey County Prosecutor John Choi explained yesterday, he had used this reasoning on the criminal charges, and he said this.
No reasonable officer knowing, seeing, and hearing what Officer Yanez did at the time would have used deadly force under these circumstances.
We're turning now to Ginger Charles. She's a former police sergeant and presidential fellow at Saybrook University, and she joins us today from Modesto, California. Ginger, welcome back to the show. It's good to talk to you again.
Thank you very much. Glad to be with you.
How unusual is it that a police officer would face these kinds of charges? There are two felony firearm charges, but the big one is the second-degree manslaughter.
Well, I think with our current culture, it certainly is becoming more usual. What is somewhat unusual is the concept of actually finding our police officers guilty. That's the bigger problem right there. That's more unusual because of the fact that we entrust them with our lives and our public trust. And it makes it very difficult for them to then go back and convict them for something.
There are some in the community and perhaps some among Mr. Castile's, the victim in this case, family, who believe that that is too light of a charge. And then I heard an attorney say yesterday, we have to be careful that we don't overcharge in a case like this. In fact, we'd rather err on the side of undercharging. What does that say to you?
So when the prosecuting attorneys look at what they can charge in this, they obviously look at what can they prove in a court of law. If they overcharge that, then they run the risk of the officer being acquitted, and the overcharge may not fit the circumstances of the case. And so that's why they would look at a lesser charge than what the victim might want, the victim family might want.
What will prosecutors have to persuade the jury of in a second-degree manslaughter case? I mean, if there is a jury trial, how will jurors have to understand this? Do you have a sense of that?
I don't know if I can answer that directly, since we're talking about a different state and different laws as far as how they define manslaughter. I would say that they're going to have to present their case and show, obviously, that there was this interaction between Philandro and Officer Yanez, and that there was unjustifiable use of force, and there was a death. So those are just very basically some of the things that would happen with that particular case.
You and I have talked about the power and sometimes the confusion that video introduces into a case like this. What kind of thoughts do you have about, the video sees a lot, but it doesn't see all in this case. What might that mean for a jury trial?
Well, I think I was very surprised when I watched the video that Diamond had posted, and I understand that I'm not seeing the kind of the pre-shots to this whole scenario here. But
right.
The one thing that I noticed was the amount of fear that I heard in Officer Yanez's voice and the amount of calmness I heard from Diamond. So that tells me that there's kind of this interesting shift in emotions. Diamond certainly would be understandably in shock or could be over-traumatized from living in that community. Officer Yanez certainly can recognize the consequences of his actions, or he may be responding in a way that I believe is actually having a huge effect on our police culture,
mm-hmm.
which is the statement that Prosecutor Choi used yesterday, which is unreasonable fear.
When you say you think it's let me explain this. Diamond Reynolds, just for anybody who hasn't followed the case that closely, is Philando Castile's girlfriend. She was in the car along with her 4-year-old daughter, and she began recording this and putting it up on Facebook Live. And so we have the benefit of that video as well. When you say that you believe that we're seeing something that is quite important overall to police culture here, some of what we saw in this video? What is that?
Well, there are quite a few things, but I just thought I would break it down into kind of a simplified look at it, even though this is much more complex. If you are looking at the kinds of thinking that are going on within our police community, if you look at classical conditioning, which is the lowest level of thinking, it is a reaction. So I see movement, I shoot. If you look at the next stage of how we might look at that situation, it might be operant conditioning, which means that I understand there are consequences, but I shoot when I see movement because I know that that could be a gun. Then you have observational learning, which means I've watched my fellow police officers do this same thing and get away with it. I've watched my same police officers do this and say this had to happen in order for me to do this, or I've watched my fellow officers die because there has been a hand movement, so I shoot. Mm-hmm. The last stage, which is the best stage that we need to be in, and it's probably why we don't have more violence in our community, because we do have a lot of officers who do function at a higher level of thinking, and that is cognitive flexibility using the frontal lobes. So it is looking at the situation and being able to problem solve it immediately and think, all right, do I step back? Do I move? How do I shift? Do I call for backup? So we're engaging other problem solving and analysis with that. So that's just a real simplified look of where this goes in a brain. So if we're creating cultures of fear in the police department or in any police culture, this is where we start then reacting at the bottom level because we're separating ourselves from the community and it becomes us versus them or it becomes a war.
Ginger Charles is with us. If you've just joined the conversation, she's a former police sergeant, a professor of psychology, and a presidential fellow at Saybrook University. Now, if you have questions specifically about what she just talked about, the psychology of this and how this may be affecting the way other police departments are handling these kinds of questions and training as well. I want to talk to Ginger about that. Specifically on questions about that, the psychology element of this, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and I'm on Twitter at Carrie NPR. Here's the other thing I wanted to ask you about, Ginger, and you've kind of led to this. The video makes clear that things were moving very quickly. It was chaotic. Officer Yanez was afraid. How are police officers then trained to make those kinds of reasonable decisions, the decisions that you just described, in the midst of something like this? So how does the training meet that?
I think there are a couple ways that this happens. One is the over-militarization in our police culture. Now, I do believe that there are times where we do need that function. However, to over-militarize our police officers begins to set up this culture of fear and over-policing and a fearful nature about us versus them in a war. The other thing that happens, too, is that we have begun to see that there's not much diversity, and I'm not talking about ethnicity or religion, I'm talking about diversity of thought on how we train police. So that band of knowledge becomes narrower and narrower rather than taking a look at some other objective outside opinions about what's going on or objective knowledge outside of the business of policing.
Okay, so when you say diversity of thought, I mean, who might be brought in on these training regimens that would introduce that kind of diversity of thought?
So you might have certain community leaders that talk about community engagement, community policing. You might have, when you talk about maybe some physical training along with mental training, you begin to talk about, all right, what are some things that you can do in order to problem solve through the physical encounter? And then finally, you may have some psychology instructors that come in and talk about, well, how does the brain function? And then also you may have communication experts who come in and talk about this is why we de-escalate.
Okay. Call here for you from Bob in St. Paul. Good morning, Bob.
Hey, thanks. This goes to the training issue. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if there would be a way to look at people coming in who want to be police officers to get a sense of their own concept of mortality. I think part of the issue is that there's, always this kind of, that that in these situations, if you're calm and have more of a sense of, yeah, I don't want to die, but I realize I might in a given situation, that there's more of just kind of an overall, like a calmness or acceptance of that aspect.
Ginger, what do you think of that?
I think that is something that should be taught, and I would have to agree with Bob. I don't think that that's being taught very well anymore. There's, again, more fear around that. So there is a calmness and understanding. I have decided to place myself in front of the community in order to protect the community, and I recognize that that may mean laying my life down, and so I need to accept what that looks like in order to proceed in a calm manner.
Call here from Tara in Minneapolis. Hi, Tara.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
This conversation is making me think a lot about Michael Brown and the officer that shot him, and I just keep thinking of the statement he made about him seeming, Michael Brown seeming like a demon coming at him,
uh-huh.
and just thinking there's so much anger at that officer, and I share in that anger, but it kept making me think about the greater kind of system in which we live, where it's somewhat normal to feel that way about a large African-American man. And we talk a lot about, you know, the system of racism or the infrastructure, but I think that that can be kind of nebulous for a lot of people. And to me, that was like a real example of trying to look at ourselves and the world in which we live in that makes people actually see an African-American man as a demon.
Yeah, Ginger, good observation there. What would you say?
Well, I agree. I think when you start looking at how we respond from a social psychological perspective, it's very difficult to break through some of that and have that person understand it is not us versus them. It, you know, we're all connected, and we have to take a look that there are people who do evil things, but we can't necessarily attach this demonistic viewpoint of a particular kind of people. That is completely wrong, and that is definitely the definition of prejudice.
You know, Ginger, I feel like you get young men and women who are in their 20s, right, especially if they've had a college education before they come into these police departments. I mean, in some ways, you know, they have been partially formed already by the culture, by a lot of the conditioning and a lot of the messaging that we're exposed to from the time we're little kids. It's really hard to change that for somebody who's now coming into this job, and you're asking them to think quite differently and apart from that, isn't it?
You know, that's a great question, and I think I would have to hopefully disagree with you, because
okay.
you see a great amount of change that goes through police officers if a culture supports this. So then if a culture supports this diverse type of thinking and engagement with community, then that line of thinking is no longer accepted, and so you start to see some shift. It's how you see people break out of racist behavior and thought. So there is a lot of hope, but it will not come to fruition until we have some significant changes in our police culture. And I've dedicated my life to helping in whatever way I possibly can. I know we can do this.
So are you seeing the kind of robust training curriculum that you're talking about in enough police departments, or is this really just getting started?
No, I'm not seeing it. In fact, what I have seen when I've given presentations around in the Bay Area in California, what I have seen is this reticence from the police leadership, not from the boots on the ground. I've seen it from the not wanting to come to the table quite as quickly as we would like.
Huh.
I think there's the defensiveness of, you know, I don't want to be wrong. I don't want to have to look at this. This is really ugly, and it is ugly, but this is something that we do need to look at. How are we contributing to this problem in our culture? And we can do it.
A call from Justin in Minneapolis. Hi, Justin. How are you thinking about this?
Well, I guess my question would be, and I'm sure that the number is really high, but I'm wondering how many officers from the military that have seen combat.
Mm-hmm.
I can speak from experience that when you get out, you don't get a whole lot of psychological reset, really. So they go from being, you know, combat militants in our military to, you know, having that like mind frame on our streets.
Yeah, that's a good element of this. Ginger, how about that?
Boy, Justin just nailed it. We need to provide training in regards to that because they are an invaluable resource for becoming great police officers in our society. But we do need to help them with that reset too, and you know, kind of reintegrating back into a civilian type of lifestyle here.
And a call for you, Ginger, from Allison in St. Paul. Hi, Allison.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Uh-huh.
I just heard the Michael Brown and the demonization, mm-hmm. and it just struck a chord with me, the psychology of that as members of society, let alone police officers. Like, I know for myself, if I'm in a parking lot and it's dark and there's a white person and a black person, all things being equal, I'm going to be more afraid in the situation with a black person. And I know that that's wrong, but how do I, as a member of our culture and a person in this society, rewrite that narrative? Where do I find, how do I change that psychology in my brain?
Okay. I think that's an excellent question, and you're on your way to it right there. It's acknowledging those underlying thoughts, the implicit biases that we all have to one degree or another. And so we begin to insert ourselves in communities where we are different from the rest of the community. We begin to have conversations, and we begin to talk about, well, I have this thought. Can somebody help me with this? And have dialogue. That's how we get out of it. And that's how we help police officers do that, too.
Ginger, I'm going to put you on the spot here. We have a lot more calls. We have another show planned, but we clearly need to have a wider conversation about the psychology of policing. Would you come back? And,
yes.
And do that?
Yes.
Okay, good.
Absolutely.
We'll schedule that in the next couple of weeks so we can get to that. And I just really always appreciate your views on this and your insight. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
Ginger Charles is a former police sergeant. She's a presidential fellow at Saybrook University and a professor of psychology at a college in California. Just want to tell you that within the next couple of weeks, we'll book this show on the psychology of policing. There's a lot more to talk, just beyond what's happening in our community. It would be interesting, too. I think this might be an important element of that, to take a look at a police department where they are doing some of what Ginger says. Now, she says this is just starting to happen, but I'm hoping we can find a police department with some perspective on trying to work in these ideas and these differences in training. So more of your calls and questions in that conversation.